Hello and welcome everyone to Teaching Peace in Schools, Cultivating Restorative School Communities. Believe it or not, this is session 10. We're at our last session tonight, or wherever it is that you are in the world. I know our learning community has been comprised of people from many different areas in our world. So I'm feeling very grateful for spending this 10 weeks with you, and I hope that it's been as rewarding for you as it has been for me, and I know it has been for many of our faculty. So tonight, we of course are going to go just as we have before. We'll have time for Q&A and for conversation with our wonderful guest faculty tonight. And we'll prompt that periodically when it's appropriate throughout tonight's presentation and conversation. And I want to thank our co-presenters, the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice, that's nacrj.org, as well as the Peace Alliance, peacealliance.org. There's a couple notes for you if you haven't already taken care of your CEUs. I just want to make a reminder to you, we do have a credential sheet that you can use for that purpose. I believe there's about 16 and a half hours total that you can use towards continuing education credits. So just please remember, if you haven't already done that, I'm guessing most of you have that are going to, please email Katrina, our wonderful course administrator, who's done incredible work on the back end throughout this three-month period. That's Katrina at peacealliance.org. Katrina at peacealliance, all one word, .org. And secondly, don't forget that you have an incredible resource section that's for you, sustaining your needs around learning and using the tools that we've been sharing throughout each week. And that can be found, again, of course, I know I say it a lot, but don't forget that it's yours for the use at peacealliance.org/teach-course-page. I'd also like to thank all of our affiliate partners. This was a collaborative effort of great magnitude, and many people went to very hard work to make sure that the word got out for this opportunity of learning. So thank you to all of our affiliate partners. They are listed on the course page as well as on your back-end resource page. So please make sure to make note of who those wonderful organizations are, to thank them and to continue to participate in their offerings as well. So without further ado, again, welcome, and my name is Molly Rowan Leach. It's my honor to be your host, executive producer of Restorative Justice on the Rise as well, a program that has been in the works for over 5 years. And for more information about Restorative Justice on the Rise, you can visit restorativejusticeontherise.org. Tonight's guest, faculty, Jeffrey Weisberg and Leah Fox, just two amazing human beings. One of them, Jeffrey, is the executive director of the River Phoenix Center for Peacebuilding. And if you don't know much about the River Phoenix Center yet, I hope you will look into what they are up to. They've got incredible trainings coming up on the pipeline, and they're doing some incredible work in their community, cross-spectrum with schools, with local law enforcement, and with citizens, creating spaces for dialogue. Jeffrey has designed, developed, and implemented a wide range of programs and services, again, in the Gainesville, Florida area, but also throughout the United States. The River Phoenix Center for Peacebuilding is located in Gainesville, Florida. He has worked with youth, including in areas such as peer mediation, juvenile diversion programs, youth empowerment, and coming-of-age programs. And he serves as a Florida certified state mediator and also mediates cases involving juvenile offenders, family disputes, and small business conflicts. In addition, he is using restorative practices to support the Department of Juvenile Justice, the court system, schools and communities to bolster alternatives to the punishment model. He believes that by training and empowering both youth and adults to learn and practice vital communication skills, We not only create greater connections with others, but we can de-escalate conflict for a safer and more productive outcome. And Leah Fox, she is a founding board member and soon to be co-director of the Resilience Charter School, which is a middle to high school aged based on project-based learning that will open in Gainesville, Florida, just around the corner here in August of 2016. She currently facilitates social and emotional learning professional development trainings and teaches mindfulness to middle school students. She is a former New York City public school teacher and has been integrating mindfulness techniques into her teaching practice for 20 years. She's a graduate she holds a degree in education and childhood development from New York University, where she graduated magna cum laude. And I just want to applaud you, Leah, for your courage in implementing something and being a path paver and perhaps even a pioneer of this charter school upcoming here. So just a very warm welcome to each of you, Jeffrey Weisberg and Leah Fox. Welcome.
Great. Thank you so much, Molly, and welcome to all our learners on the phone tonight. It's so wonderful to be with you folks. And golly, congratulations to everyone who's been a part of this 10 series. I just think that this is such an important learning opportunity for people around the world, and to take some of these best practices and ideas and implementing them. So I wanted to start really with, you can go ahead and switch two slides if you would, Molly, a little bit about peace building, that it's really a fascinating and emerging field that restorative justice is one part of. But to me, part of the distinction around peacebuilding versus peacekeeping is that in peacekeeping, it's usually to help stabilize a country, a city, an environment that is experiencing violence and war. And they're called in to help facilitate and manage that process. But once violence has abated and is stabilized, then peace builders need to come in to the community and bring those resources and best practices to help lift up all people in the community and in society. And that includes in education, in economic opportunities, in political arenas, and law enforcement. All of these areas need to really have new structures and new thinking to help maximize the opportunity and the potential for peace. And so we really got our inspiration from the Department of Peace legislation that some of you may be familiar with, and brought that idea to a local level. And we've been operating for about 3 years and developed a number of different pillars and tracks of what we feel are essential elements of peace building. And one of those that we're going to be talking about tonight is around social emotional learning. And that when you think about conflict in schools or in the workplace, it's generally between two or more people and a breakdown in that communication. So imagine if everyone were trained in conflict resolution and communication skills and had the ability to navigate these challenging situations that are inevitable and that will arise. And I love this quote, that we can't solve the problem on the level in which it was created. We really do need new thinking and new structures, because the punitive model of our justice system just really does not work. You can go to the next slide. And what if each community had an entity or a group that sole focus was to coordinate, facilitate, and focalize best practices of peace building, and was a hub to help implement these into existing systems. And that's what we're doing in Gainesville with the Center for Peacebuilding. Slide. And we want everyone to learn to resolve conflict through healthy communication. Again, this is a vital skill that is not often taught in schools or in homes, and is a major cause of violence. And we believe that when more people have these skills, that this, in fact, will break the cycle of violence. So you can, next slide. Part of our understanding is through this model that you see here, the socio-ecological model. And it starts with the individual and the self, and then expands out into interpersonal relationships and families and communities, and goes into institutions and organizations, and then gets into policies and larger systems. And when we're thinking about embedding restorative practices, it's really important for us to have this model in mind of how we support individuals and families and stakeholders in making these changes and embedding the resources and the new thinking and attitudes and behaviors. And what is often missing that we see in most of the young people is that they really do not have much of a sense of the impact of their behaviors. And because of that, they have less an ability to make a new choice. And that's part of the tremendous power of a circle and restorative practices, is that when we sit face to face with those who have harmed us or who we have harmed, and we get to hear and see that impact, that anybody who's a practitioner or been a part of this profound process can see that change that occurs when people actually experience and have a connection with another person. So we encourage people to use this as a model.
All right, next slide. So I wanted to talk a moment about how Jeffrey and I started working together, and also speaking about the impact of the River Phoenix Center for Peacebuilding in our county. The compassion emanating from Jeffrey and his partner, Hart, has really had a ripple effect on our community, and that social ecological model really shows how their intention as individuals has impacted the relationships close to them and other institutions and organizations, and has really had a beautiful impact on the development and the coming to fruition of the vision for Resilience Charter School. We have been, they've worked on our advisory board, and they've really, creating in our community a dialogue around the importance for social emotional learning has really allowed us to sort of ride on that wave of understanding that is a new understanding in our community, this need for helping not only youth but the wider community to really value social emotional learning and have that insight into themselves and building their capacity in healthy communication. So I see Resilience Charter School as riding this wave, the wave done by their work, and I think it's really beautifully reflected in the social ecological model. So next slide. So I wanted just to briefly talk a little bit about how the process of learning and the cultivation of resilience are a continual cycle of stumbling and rising. Usually when youth are stumbling, we don't really hold space for that. We have very, punitive culture and social emotional learning is a way for us as a community to hold space for healthy conflict resolution. Slide.
So this is a model of an iceberg that we use very, very often in a lot of our classes and teaching. And what we see is behaviors, what we see is violence or fighting or bullying and rape and stealing and those kinds of behaviors. Those are what we would say are above the waterline. But what is it that's really driving that behavior? And how often do we take a look at what are the circumstances that cause people to do what they do? And in a restorative practice and in using that model of an iceberg, we think that it's really important to have an understanding in the larger circle of stakeholders and supporters of what drives that behavior. And we, Marshall Rosenberg, who's the founder and developer of nonviolent communication, he often says that all violence is an expression of an unmet need. And so as practitioners, when we're looking at the larger system, how is it built in to our process for us to support the originating behaviors so that ultimately that changes and can be prevented from happening in the future? Next slide. And one of the areas that we wanted to share with you folks tonight for your consideration is this whole idea of trauma, or what's called adverse childhood experiences. And there's tremendous research and studies going on, but the ACE studies was done back in 95 to 97 out in California with the Center of Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente, where they were discovering certain trends about illness, and they wanted to find some of the root causes. And next slide. And what they found was some similarities of behavior and experiences that young people had that oftentimes had lifelong consequences. And so what one definition of trauma is experiences or situations that are emotionally painful and distressing, and this is the core point here, that overwhelm people's ability to cope, often leaving them powerless. And that and in some cases, trauma can occur frequently and become part of a common human experience. People who are living in slavery or chronic poverty or perpetual abuse, those kinds of traumatic experiences in some cases can be every day. So what's really important for us to consider as practitioners is what kind of behavior is coming into the circle, and what do these people, and particularly young people, may they have experienced that's playing out in the interactions. Slide. And so here's a couple, some statistics of the studies that they've shown around adverse childhood experiences, that young children exposed to five or more significant adverse experiences in the first 3 years of childhood face a 76% likelihood of having one or more delays in their language, emotional, or brain development. One in five children witnessing violence in their family or neighborhoods in the previous year. More than 13% of children reported being physically bullied, while more than one in three said that they've been emotionally bullied. Next slide. And that 26% of children in the United States will witness or experience a traumatic event before they turn 4, which is a staggering number, 1 in 4 children. And in our practice of restorative justice in Gainesville, many of the cases that we get are diversions from the state attorney's office, and we have a specific grant for domestic battery charges, and where a young person has hit their parent or grandparent or sibling. And what we're finding is that oftentimes there's a cycle of violence that exists within the home. And so it's no wonder that we're seeing some of this behavior kind of carry on and perpetuate. Slide. You can go to the toxic stress, next one. So one of the results of trauma is something called toxic stress, and there's a lot of research and writing on toxic stress, but it's distinct from healthy stress, and that children need challenging situations to learn how to ride a bike or to how to use scissors or how to draw and write and how to problem solve. But when you when young people don't get regular response to fulfill their needs, or when they witness violence or experience direct abuse or neglect, that these things are all responsible for psychological, emotional, and mental health problems that in many cases can have long-term health effects. Slide. And these are some of the primary areas where people experience toxic stress. Neglect, abuse, witnessing or hearing violence, parents fighting, stress around food, money, and relationships, bullying, and abandonment. And what some studies show is that neglect is actually one of the leading causes of toxic stress. That parents sometimes have 2 jobs, maybe 3 jobs. Maybe there's only 1 parent at home, parenting numerous children. And those kinds of dynamics where young people just are not getting the regular support and input fulfilling their needs can have negative and long-lasting effects. Slide. And here is some examples of what probably all of us have experienced something on this list: lack of money or challenging mental health, teenage pregnancy, poor nutrition, a death of a loved one, a traumatic health event. All of these can have really significant challenges. And again, what is the factor that enables one child to kind of get up and brush themselves off and move forward, whereas another child, in some cases even in the same family, has a lot more difficulty rebounding, and that concept of resilience, of getting up and moving forward towards their goals and dreams. Slide. And this is kind of a painful slide here that you see of 2 3-year-olds, one of normal development and one who has extreme neglect and sensory deprivation, and this can't be downplayed at all in terms of the effect of children being able to articulate and communicate, problem solve, learn, self-regulation. All of those are profoundly affected by, in this case, neglect, but certain kinds of trauma. And we had a case a couple days ago where 2 brothers each got charged with fighting, and we did a restorative process with both of them and their family and some support people. And one of the boys had experienced sexual abuse and neglect and other forms of trauma more than the other brother. And it was so apparent his inability to understand the impact and to communicate and to self-regulate. He was kind of playing with pens and a little bit really uncomfortable in his chair and moving around. And so what we really tried to do is to bring in his counselor and his probation officer and his family to look at what other services might support this young man in clearly not only fulfilling his agreement, but in his own development. And slide. And these next four slides all are from that ACE studies. And you can see the number of adverse childhood experiences in the various colors, 1, 2, 3, 4, and the percentage of increase in likelihood of adult alcoholism. And you can just kind of go through those next three slides a bit quickly. So that's alcoholism. This next one is the risk of perpetrating domestic violence and what a huge jump it is for both women and men as they reach 4 and 5 ACEs. And the next slide is around the likelihood of being raped. Very, very significant jump. And the last one is the likelihood of a suicide attempt. So if you're not familiar with the ACE studies and trauma, we really encourage practitioners and people who are embedding restorative justice into schools and other systems to bring in other stakeholders and supporters around how to build resilience. How do you break this cycle of violence? And to give young people and their families and other caretakers necessary resources to heal from that. And next slide. So these are some of the consequences of toxic stress. And what I think is important for us to consider is that many of these behaviors or elements of behavior are where we interface with discipline and referrals and arrests. And that it's just important to consider what else might be driving this behavior. Clearly we have little rascals and shenanigans that exist, but what we see over and over is that the majority of many of these kinds of behaviors are a result of adverse childhood experiences. Slide. So violence is a learned behavior. And Gary Slutkin is an epidemiologist who works in Chicago, and he helped found the Interrupters, which is just a wonderful program of men and women who have been in gangs or in prison, and they're trained to be violence interrupters and mediators, and they go into hotspots in throughout Chicago to break the cycle of guns and violence. And so what's important, I think, for us to consider is who are we or how are we modeling ourselves as adults, as caregivers, as practitioners, as teachers, and as parents, and what are we showing our young people? And so when we think back to that socio-ecological model, starting with ourselves, for us to continue to do our work. You can go to the next slide. And here's another, just a contrast of taking a walk in a park to Afghanistan, where a father-son are holding machine guns. And so what is the input that we are providing as parents and teachers, educators, but also as facilitators in this work, so that we can be planting the seeds of resiliency and communication and conflict resolution and personal responsibility. Next slide. And I love this image of just the communication going back and forth that we can learn from each other just by watching. And the last slide that I have before we have a break and a discussion, you can go to the next slide, is our old friend Maslow, which still has incredible relevance, I think, in our practice of restorative justice, that many of the cases that we particularly see is because young people are operating kind of on that base level of physiological and safety needs. And, you know, if you've ever been there or you've worked with people in that position, those higher elements of safety and friendship and confidence and empathy is much harder to practice and emphasize. So as practitioners, how are we supporting not only those base levels of physiological and safety needs, but through the communication and the opportunities for them to see the impact and to have a voice and a choice of the components of an agreement, all of those foster a sense of belonging and esteem to move our young people into higher realms of their life trajectory. Slide. So we wanted to just pause for a few minutes, because I'm not one to be a great lecturer or take a long-winded in that sense, and we really want to hear from you. And so the first question is, what is the relationship between disruptive behaviors, trauma, and restorative practices? And I'm wondering if any of you have some thoughts of cases that you've experienced or challenging behaviors, and how to join and serve those young people while using restorative practices. So Molly, maybe we can open it up and see if folks have some thoughts or questions.
Wonderful. And just a reminder, let's open up the conversation by just simply pressing 1 on your telephone keypad, and that will cue us that you'd like to get involved. Great. I'm passing the mic to Kamali. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
That's Kamali.
Kamali. Beautiful name. Kamali.
Thank you very
Welcome.
Much. I'm. Thank you very much. I teach Hawaiian studies at the Pacific Heritage Academy in Rose Park, Utah. And I just wanted to say, first off, there's a film called Paper Tigers. It was created by Jamie Redford, and he went to the Lincoln Alternative School in Walla Walla, Washington, and they actually teach their kids about ACEs, because their kids have, you know, they let them score themselves on that, so that they're giving them that cognitive development. And it's actually playing here in Utah on the 26th at our Marmalade Library. So, and I recommend that film for any educator, because it gives you the real appearance of what ACEs does in our community and in our school, and it shows what those educators have done to help and support their kids in their school. And one of the biggest elements was forgiveness with the behavior and the additional trauma that can come from our poor judgment. we should be able to get to a point with our kids where we're willing to kneel down to them and let them have out what they need to have out, and then realize it's not aimed at us, there are other things behind it. But I wanted to say that in my classroom, I have junior high kids all year long, and when I first started teaching, they were always at each other's throat, throwing things at each other. I had a boy run out screaming and crying. So a lot of my first lessons were about doing things together and creating the peace in the classroom. I kind of had to own my space and say, this is for everyone to feel safe and not be judged. So now we're in our fourth term. I have kids breaking down and crying, but to share their feelings and experiences. And the way that I've done that is I had to teach them how to treat one another, where I was the first one to treat them kindly and with respect and forgiveness and build a stronger relationship with them so that they could do that with each other. And hopefully they can take this home. And I have developed a relationship with a lot of their families, so that consistency is there also.
I love that. Thank you so much. I have seen that film. We've brought it to Gainesville and had a couple different showings. But it's such a beautiful example of kind of embedding those practices and building resilience into existing systems like that and empowering the young people. So I'm really happy to hear that you're able to do that in Utah, and it speaks to that second part of that question, how might we better support our youth and families and systems? So those are great examples, and I hope we can just keep expanding it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kamaili. I'll go ahead and pass the mic on to Kim. Welcome, Kim. Hi.
Hello. Hi. Hello. Gosh, I'm just loving this conversation. Thank you so much, everyone. I'm thinking deeply about this and looking at the question, what is the relationship between disruptive behaviors, trauma, and restorative practices? Every day I've been thinking about that. I know there is a relationship there. And drawing back to my own experiences as a young person, I just see so many connections there. But something that I heard the other day in this workshop called Creative Advantage, where we're trying to get more arts education into schools, we were talking about flipping the deficiencies. So taking those behaviors that we see and judge as deficiencies and turning them into leadership skills. So, for example, one of the youth in our mentoring program across the bridge, I know they like to talk a lot. They like to draw attention. And, instead of getting annoyed that my own schedule or, agenda was being interrupted, I made an effort to talk with that young person and say, I've noticed you're a real leader, and, would you help me greet everyone as they come in and, support our group that way. You're so good at being a leader, and everyone listens to you. So, and that just changes the whole feeling in the room, and I really, the relationship is strong right there. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's beautiful. We've seen some other examples of what some people call positive discipline, and it's about that empowerment of the young people and helping to reframe and transform some of their maybe disruptive behaviors into constructive contributions to a larger community in that sense. So thank you for bringing that up, because I think when we can also insert that into the conversation or invite that into the conversation in a restorative circle, that that's where some really significant shifts can happen in people's perceptions and sense of value and belonging. So let us continue to take that concept forward of, a lot of times young people are acting out from a sense that they don't have a lot of power or choice, and how might we support that reframe? So thank you.
Yes, exactly. Centering the youth voice and helping them heal, through expression, through expressing themselves. Yes, thank you so much.
Yay. So maybe we should...
Kim,
we could take one more, and then we're going to move on to Leah.
And I just wanted to say, Kim, would you mind stating that again? Was it called flipping the discrepancies? Is that how you stated it?
Oh, flipping the deficiencies.
Deficiencies.
Flipping.
Excellent.
Yeah, flipping the deficiencies.
Very inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah, that
Thank
sounds
you so
ideal.
Much.
Thank you, Molly.
So, Molly, do you want to go? Shall we move on, or?
It looks like it's a good time to move on. I don't see anybody else wanting to get involved in the conversation at this point. So,
great.
Let's proceed.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay, so next slide. We're going to talk a little, go into social and emotional learning, but I also wanted to comment on the flipping the deficiencies. I love that way of framing, reframing, and how so often children who have experienced a lot of adverse childhood experiences and are sort of stuck in patterns of what we might call misbehavior. They are often not really being seen. What's being seen is the strategies that they're using to try to meet needs that they may not be in touch with. And so flipping the deficiency sounds like it's really giving them an opportunity to be seen on a deeper level. It's very beautiful. So here we see this is the sort of basic elements of social-emotional learning, which many of you may be familiar with, self-awareness, responsible decision-making, relationship skills, social awareness, and self-management. Next slide, please. I'm going to talk a little bit about, focus on a few of these elements, self-awareness, so knowing what we are feeling in the moment. So often when people are triggered, they are not really aware of what they're feeling in the moment. So being able to recognize or label emotions is huge. It's being able to sense emotions in the body. We have labels for emotions, but emotions are actually, they show up as felt sensations in the body. And knowing what causes certain emotions for us, knowing particular triggers specific to ourselves, knowing both our strengths and what we need to work on as well as a part of self-awareness. Slide. So self-management, so using strategies to calm ourselves, so being able to handle our emotions so that they can support us in our communication and like give us point to the needs that we have when we're having an emotional reaction so that we can sort of see, well, what's the need going on here. Acting with integrity is connected to self-management as well. Being conscientious and delaying gratification to pursue goals. We know that this is really important for both thriving academically and professionally outside of school, this being able to delay gratification for a longer-term goal. And persevering despite setbacks and frustration. And also a solutionary approach to problems is connected to self-management. Slide. So social awareness, so we know that the more we are in touch with our own feelings, the more we can go deeper and really have more self-reflection. That's really correlated with having increased awareness of other people's feelings. So social awareness has to do with sensing what others are feeling, being able to take other people's perspectives, and being able to interact with a diverse spectrum of people. Social awareness is really connected to cultivating cultural competency and picking up on social cues and empathy. Slide. So social management, so being able to handle our emotions and relationships effectively, establishing and maintaining healthy relationships. Also being able to recognize the difference between positive patterns and relationships and negative patterns and relationships connected to social management. Resisting inappropriate social pressure or peer pressure, and negotiating solutions to conflict and seeking help when needed. Slide. So I wanted to make a connection here between social emotional learning and how that really shows up in the restorative justice process. So when responding to harm in restorative processes, we ask the following questions. So who has been harmed? What do they need to move forward? Who is responsible for making things right? So the questioning is very different from a punitive system, which is more, what rule was broken, who broke it, and how should they be punished. So this framing in the restorative process really is allowing youth and adults to practice the social and emotional elements that I just went over. So the social and emotional elements look great, and we can all kind of agree that we would like to foster them and cultivate them for ourselves and for the youth we work with and the people in our lives. Next slide, please. But the question is, where do we start? So this has been a theme, I think, throughout the 10 sessions, and something we talked about tonight with this socio-ecological model is that it really starts with ourselves. It's really important that we are creating time for caring for ourselves and time for self-reflection, and it's not always so easy in our very fast-paced world, and as youth providers and teachers and educators, we are giving a lot. And it's very easy to get into patterns of not making space for ourselves. So next slide, please. I wanted to touch again on what Chris McKenna from Mindful Schools talked about and bring up this quote again, because I think it's so powerful when we're thinking about the importance of starting with ourselves. So I have here, be the change, and again, this quote that current scientific findings are clear that in order to regulate emotions, which is one of the most critical right hemisphere functions, youth are dependent on mature brains to assist in the micro-regulation of their physical and emotional world. So this is speaking to our evolutionary biology and how youth are really looking to us to regulate. So, and this is happening in very, subtle ways. So the more that we are at peace and the more that we are calm and the more we've cultivated our social and emotional intelligence, we are automatically creating this sort of anchor for the youth we work with to resonate with. Slide. So again, with the mirror neurons, a lot of this regulation is happening through mirror neurons, and we're constantly communicating through really subtle expressions in our faces. Our emotions are show up on our faces, and so we often, in dealing with situations with youth, teachers, it's pretty much a daily experience that we experience frustration. And the more we are in touch with our frustration, the felt sense of frustration, the more we're able to clearly communicate without having that anger or frustration be the main message that the youth we're working with are picking up on. And I guess what I'm really trying to say is that very often we're saying one thing that we think, maybe we're using nonviolent communication and we're trying to do quote unquote the right thing, but often if we're not giving ourselves that space and time of self-reflection and taking the time for self-care, they're getting a very different message from the way we're communicating with our presence. Slide. So how do we start? I believe strongly from my experience that we start with mindfulness. This is also something that Chris is talking about. I think it's really crucial that we create the space for ourselves and for youth to just be as opposed to constantly doing. And if we don't take that time to be and notice what's going on within ourselves, then if we are entering a stressful situation or a conflict, we're much less likely to be in touch with what's going on with ourselves so that we can deal with that situation with clarity. Slide. So I see mindfulness practices as foundational to social-emotional learning, and I love this quote from Viktor Frankl. Between the stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space lies our freedom and our power to choose our response. So I know personally in my life, mindfulness has been a way for me to create this space so that I can not impulsively react to situations, but respond more mindfully. And when I talk with youth about my experience with my own anger and times where I have reacted impulsively, I can just feel, it's like a palpable sense in the room that they can relate to the speed that anger can have specifically, and how it really can feel like there is absolutely no space. It's like there was a trigger and there was the instantaneous reaction. So making this distinction for youth is really powerful between reaction and response. And response is when there's that space. And a beautiful way of cultivating, the most powerful way I've experienced of cultivating that space is through mindfulness practices. Slide. So this shows us some of the different benefits of mindfulness practices, and I wanted to sort of highlight how they really beautifully parallel the different elements of social-emotional learning. So cultivating positive attitude to perceive stress facilitates sustained attention. That's something I always emphasize when working with teachers who are not so sure about mindfulness, is this that's one of the main areas that specifically with youth that we know about the impact of mindfulness is around attention and emotional regulation. So mindfulness decreases the tendency to self-reference, enhances emotional intelligence. So we can just see that all of these different benefits of mindfulness really beautifully parallel what we are trying to foster as we cultivate social and emotional intelligence. Slide. So I wanted to say briefly how we the importance of practicing noticing what's happening for ourselves outside of stressful situations. And we can't really expect students to be tuned in when they are having a flight or flight response to a situation. So this goes into how naming feelings starts to relieve stress. So naming the feeling activates the prefrontal cortex. So the moment that we or youth can identify the feeling that's going on, and better yet, allow themselves to feel the sensation of that feeling, then the prefrontal cortex sends calming GABA to the amygdala so that the amygdala stops firing. And so that when the amygdala is calm, then it allows the hippocampus to come back online to do the work of contextualizing,
And again, the prefrontal cortex is even more online, so that they're able to utilize some of those concepts that we've been teaching them to support them in strategizing in stressful situations. So as the sensations in the body are identified, the right hemisphere begins to modulate stress and engage the whole brain to allow for self-awareness and empathy, so that they're able to then hopefully take the perspective of the people around them. Slide. So I wanted to emphasize, obviously, mindfulness, but also talk about the power of story. And I have been using story as a way, as a springboard to engage students, you know, in all areas of my teaching. And I think stories have a really powerful place in restorative processes, because ultimately, what we're doing in the restorative justice circle is a retelling of what happened and what the impact was. Mm-hmm. And we know that stories transport us into other people's worlds, and that they actually alter our brain chemistry. So I find this so thrilling, that this research around how the brain releases oxytocin when we're engaged in a story. And this is associated with care and connection and empathy. Oxytocin is, you know, released when a mother is nursing her child, and so it has to do with building trust. And it's really beautiful to highlight how this is kind of is embedded in the restorative processes when we're sharing what happened and allowing the people who have been harmed and the people who have done the harm to have the privilege of empathizing through the stories that are being told. So I'm really excited about, you know, using story through improv and through, you know, highlighting stories that kids are already excited about, and using it as a way to really engage students in social and emotional learning overall. I think it's a really powerful tool that is sometimes not made explicit. So I wanted to hear from listeners about how they have integrated social emotional learning into their work and what tools they've used that have been really powerful. And another question I had was how, or maybe retelling a time when you really resonated with a student that you were working with, and what you felt was sort of the key aspect that allowed you to connect with a student that perhaps you had a difficult time with connecting with at first. So those two questions. One, what are some tools that you've used that have been really effective in getting students excited about social-emotional learning? And two, a time that you may have really connected and resonated with a student? So we can open it.
Those are great questions. Please get involved if you're so moved in the conversation, again, by pressing 1 on your keypad. And did you have a slide, Leah, that you'd like to go with this part of our sharing time?
No, Molly,
or are we at the right one?
I repeat the question if necessary, but I don't have a slide.
Okay. I'm sure there's people out there that have an experience to share. I know I do, but I'm going to defer to the community here.
Or if somebody had a question around the relationship between social-emotional learning and restorative practices, might also be a question
yes.
that somebody has.
Yeah, any questions as well.
Or thoughts or comments.
Wonderful. I love that. It's also a great framework because I know that a lot of people are hungry to apply the principles. I'll pass the mic to Louise. Welcome, Louise.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Hi.
Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great. Great conversation. My contribution is not so much around youth, but did some RJ work with people in prisons. And I cannot tell you the impact of the opportunity for them to offer their story. And I'm sure it's the same with youth who are involved in discipline or have less than desirable home lives, but no one takes the time to let them tell their story. And that's exactly what happens in the circle, as you well know, and just the impact and the emotion that comes with the first chance they've ever had to actually get it out there and have it be heard and have it accepted in a non-judgmental way is absolutely unbelievable. So I really agree with what you're saying, that it just lets people have that chance. And like you're saying, you know, some people don't get the chance to tell their stories in their life because their lives are so messed up that they just have to go through it. They have no chance to stop and reflect it.
Thank you. Yes, that's really true, and there it is sort of reflected on a neurological level when we are able to tell our stories of trauma, that it helps to synthesize the right and left hemisphere of the brain, called narrative integration, and we know that adults who or parents who have had a lot of trauma in their childhood, they are able to attach better with their children if they have had that narrative integration and made sense of the pain and wounds of their past. So thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Louise. I'd like to go ahead and pass along the mic to someone that is raising their hand from what is called the generic line. So if that's you, welcome, and your mic is open.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Can you? Okay, great. Yes, this is Deborah Green. I guess I'm generic today. I'm the Deborah Green. Hi, guys. Hi, Beth. I'm so excited to hear about what you're talking about. I never knew that about the storytelling and the oxytocin, and it just makes me, you know, want to go back in history and learn more about that, about the release from storytelling. I just, you know, because storytelling and moral tales and passion plays have been, you know, in history forever, and that really is a place of communion. And when I worked in the jails, I used Shakespeare as the vehicle, so that kids who didn't want to tell their story could tell it through Iago or Othello or even Desdemona sometimes. And the opening that happened from that was incredible, that you ended up having gang members from different gangs working together, and that the empathy grew from them taking on these characters. And so I wanted to know if either one of you wanted to speak to, you know, where role-playing in storytelling comes up as well, in the building a community, that it's not just the release for the person who's telling the story, that it can actually be through storytelling that may not be exactly their own words, but on an emotional level are their stories. I'm wondering what you had.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. A lot of times we're not able to go there when it's about our own lives, right? And when people have had really painful experiences, they can't really always access them because it can be re-traumatizing. So using, you know, other known stories like you're describing with Shakespeare, or making up scenarios and using improv really can help to create that space to go there and explore the emotions and dynamics that can sort of mirror what your experience in real life is. And I think it's a real powerful avenue to go there when you can't necessarily access it with your own personal story.
You know, we have somebody on our staff that does a lot of theater, and I'm just getting a whole new possibility. I do know Theater of the Oppressed and some of that kind of work,
mm-hmm.
and I just see this huge opportunity for using story and role play and reframing, you know, to contribute to the restoration of relationships and harm in community and with races and gender and et cetera. So that's a wonderful seed I'm hoping many of us can nurture in our communities and in our practices of how to bring restorative justice and storytelling more creatively. So thank you for that seed there that I got out of this conversation.
You're welcome. I wanted to also say one thing along that seed, which is a group called City at Peace, which is out of L.A., bring kids together to tell their stories and to stand up and then create a story to then tell the community as a collective story. And they're a wonderful example of something like that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And part of the power of that as well, I think, is creating a new story. I think it's really important to tell the past, tell that as it has been, but how do we want to move forward? And that actually, this is a pretty good segue for us to move into this next last part of our presentation, if that's okay with you, Molly.
It's certainly okay. There is another couple hands up, but we could maybe take one more and then have some more time for conversation momentarily, or what do you prefer?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, let's go ahead and pass the mic one more time. Elizabeth, welcome.
Hi, thanks, Molly, and hi, Jeffrey and Leah. I am a third grade teacher in Ohio, and I have so many questions. I think the one that I want to focus in on now, I have benefited from, and I hope that my students have as well, with the storytelling element. I totally buy into what you're saying and describing, and the environment in the classroom shifts. I mean, you can just physically feel the shift when you're incorporating the storytelling for along the restorative justice process spectrum. And one of the stories that we've been using this year is how full is your bucket? And I forget the author right now, but it's just a story that lays out how we can either fill people's buckets and help make their day better, or we dip from their buckets and we're adding to the negativity of their day. And so my question focuses more on what you're talking about with how we are able to, I love the whole quote from Viktor Frankl, between the stimulus and the response, and so creating time in the classroom. Do you have a book or a couple of books that you would recommend? Because our school is not on board with all of this yet, and I want to do more in the classroom, and I know that that's difficult to do it isolated in the classroom, but I know that the children will absorb this whole social, emotional direction. Would you recommend, or do you have a couple of books or resources that I could just increase my own self-teaching with that I could then carry into the classroom a little bit more successfully? It's hard with 20, 30 kids for that time.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the organization of the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. It's the acronym CASEL. And that's are you familiar with them?
I am. It's just overwhelming for me. If I could just have a more maybe starting point.
Okay. I would recommend the first book that comes to mind is the Five Dimensions of Engaged Teaching. I think I have that right. I'm going to look it up real quick just to be sure. The Five Dimensions of Engaged Teaching. I feel like it is really provides a really beautiful framework for implementing social emotional learning and taking into consideration, all of the pressures that we have as teachers and everything that we're trying to do. So it really embeds it into not being sort of marginal, but really seeing social emotional learning as the foundation from which academic thriving comes. So it's called The Five Dimensions of Engaged Teaching, a Practical Guide for Educators.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Wonderful. Thank you, Leah. Yeah. I like oxytocin. Yeah. How about the next slide? Thank you. It's so funny because I found a Viktor Frankl quote myself. Everything can be taken from a man or person, but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And I chose this slide to talk briefly about another model that we use and that I'm still studying, and I'll probably be studying it for a long time, but it's called the empowerment dynamic. And it comes from a man named David Emerald, and so you can find it online, the empowerment dynamic. And what he talks about is, you can go to the next slide, is that we have two primary orientations, that we have a problem orientation and we have an outcome or solution orientation. And what's fascinating about it is that biologically and evolutionarily, we are predisposed to the problem orientation thinking, that our survival depended upon us being able to identify problems and protect ourselves. And it lives very, very, very strong in most of us, that we see the glass half empty, we see the problem before we see the solution. And, you know, there's a lot of consequences to having that kind of orientation and outlook, that and listen to yourself and listen to other people when they're sharing about an issue. And the emphasis is on the problem or on them or the behavior or this or that. And he goes further into this connection, which is what's called the drama triangle or the Cartman triangle. David Cartman developed this drama triangle, which is comprised of victim, persecutor, and rescuer. And that each of those elements, each of those distinctions has a whole range of behaviors and thinking that goes with it. And so with the persecutor or the perpetrator, it's a problem orientation, domination, blames and tears down. It's vindictive. It's kind of the tyrant, impatience and controller. And so I'm sure everybody can relate to moments maybe in your own life or certainly seeing it with other people. And it can have a huge impact on lives and on our community. And then the other one is the rescuer. It's the person who wants ultimately to help, but it's done at a cost by taking away other people's power and choice and trying to fix people. And I don't know if you're wiggling in your chair that you're a rescuer and you want to kind of take the pain away from other people and so forth, but in this context, it actually can be quite disempowering. And so I'll show you another model in a moment. And then the third is what is probably the hardest for me, is to acknowledge my own vulnerability and my feeling of not having a choice or not being able to help someone, or God bless my mother, when she's not feeling well, I feel powerless, and I hate to feel like I'm powerless and that I'm a victim. But these dynamics, particularly victim, persecutor, can go back and forth, and we can have them either simultaneously or kind of concurrently, where that much of what brings our people into a restorative practice stems from this dynamic. But thank goodness that you can go to the next slide. That it's really important, again, around this whole self-awareness idea, that where are we putting our focus? Is it on the problem or is it on the solution? And what's the impact of that on our internal state, our inner state? Are we in a place of peace or ease, or are we in a place of anxiety or upset or aggravation? And then what is the resulting behavior from that inner state? And this can be a cycle that continues around and around. And what can we do to help interrupt that, particularly if it's in that drama triangle dynamic? You can go to the next slide. And so the alternate to the drama triangle in this model is called the empowerment dynamic. And so the opposite of victim is creator, the opposite of a persecutor is a challenger, and the opposite of a rescuer is a coach. And the reason that I added this to this presentation is because as facilitators and practitioners of RJ, this is very much what we're doing and what we're trying to do is a reframe and changing attitudes, knowledge, and behavior. And this may serve many of you to consider that when someone is in this dynamic of not feeling like they have a choice, not feeling powerful, or maybe they're disruptive, or they're being bullies, or they're being combative or defiant, you know, to help challenge or to coach or to invite them to say, what is it that you want to have happen? If there was any kind of outcome that you would like to see from this session today, what would that be? And depending on kind of what model you use of restorative practice, we use one where we have a pre-conference. And so we're asking these questions of what happened, the impact, how might it look to be repaired and prevented in the future, so that when they come to the circle, they already have some thoughts about moving forward and what it is that they want versus what it is that they don't want. And so I do some coaching in those sessions, the pre-conference in particular, about kind of reframing them to think about what it is that they want, that we always have a choice. And that's why I love that quote of Viktor Frankl that says, you know, the last of human freedoms is to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And so hopefully this model can be helpful for you to start integrating and supporting other people. And the last slide here is a picture of both of those triangles together. And the drama triangle, anxiety-based, problem-focused, whereas the empowerment dynamic is passion-based, outcome-focused. And so next slide. So I'm just curious if anybody has some thoughts on how do we support others to move out of the problem orientation to the solution orientation using restorative practices. And depending on, again, your framework and training, the facilitator is usually kind of has a back seat. But there may be certain questions that we could brainstorm together that help people have that reframe of going towards what they want versus what they don't want. So I'm wondering if we could open up the line for a few moments to see if anybody has any thoughts about this model and how to support people moving into that solution orientation.
Great. Thank you so much, Jeffrey and Leah. And there were a few hands left over from the last discussion. I'm going to go ahead and put the hands down, and just in sensitivity to the fact that maybe people would like to be re-upping for this piece. But if you still would like to get involved in the conversation and have carryover from the last section, please re-raise your hand. Thank you. Okay, we'll pass the mic to Allison. Welcome, Allison.
Hi, Molly. Hi, Jeffrey. Hi, Leah. Molly and Jeffrey, I met you in Florida. I'm the one from Missouri. I was at the Dominic Barter pre-conference workshop there. Hello again.
Hello. Wonderful.
Great.
Hello. So what's coming to mind for me is, I've been really struck by the consciousness that we need to have in circles about how people in our circles may have a very wide range of adverse childhood experiences that they have or haven't had, and how to balance participation and power in the circle, how to support that being balanced, given that some people are coming having been seriously oppressed by all of these ACEs. And so when I was mulling that over when you put this question up to us about supporting moving into, out of the problem orientation, and I think that one of the main ways that I think restorative circles do that, and I'm talking about the Dominic Barter style circles where there is no one identified as a victim or a person who caused harm more than someone else. There's an author and a receiver of an act that's identified in the pre-restorative circle part of the phase. And I think that addressing things that way, where we're asking everyone the same questions in the pre-circle, we're asking everyone the same questions in the circle, seems like it would support equalizing that somewhat, so that at least in the way that we're showing up to everyone in the same way, we're not saying, oh, you are the one who was the victim, you are the one who was harmed more than other people, or you're the one more deserving, you need to be rescued or something. We're not conveying any of that if we are asking everyone the same questions. And in fact, I usually work in communities where people have known each other for a long time, and today was pre-circling with six people who were saying, thank goodness that we're having this circle finally. This has been chafing at me for a year and a half. And it's not just one act between two people. There's an ongoing dynamic. So especially in a situation like that, or in a school where kids have known each other all year, there's not just one cause, one instance of harm we're dealing with. There's a whole dynamic that's grown up with the relationship. And so that's one way that I think we do support people moving to a solution orientation, is by treating everyone with the same level of respect, regardless of how they have shown up in this particular conflict. But I'm still sitting with a lot of concern for those who can't show up, even if we treat them the same way, who can't show up with the same empowerment just because they've had so many adverse childhood experiences. And I still don't know how to address that. So I'm sitting with a lot of curiosity, wondering if anyone out there has some wisdom for me about that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the comment and your own experience and wisdom around that. Beautiful. I don't have an answer right now also.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm aware of the time, so maybe we could just take one or two more people if anybody else wants to make a comment.
Great. Thank you so much, Allison. And if anybody else would like to chime in, please, by all means, feel welcome to do so. We really have appreciated the conversations throughout this 10 weeks. Okay, I'll pass the mic to Kiri. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Molly. In the last section when we opened it up to people, the woman was talking about Have You Filled a Bucket Today? I just wanted to add the name of that book, the name by Carol McLeod. And I've also written a book. Excuse me, my voice is going. I've also written a book called Making Amends, Make Friends. It can be bought on Amazon or through my website. And it's teaching social-emotional language that we use in our peacekeeper circles, in elementary schools, in story form. So it's showing children how to use the language and appropriately make amends with conflict.
Beautiful.
And I want to thank, yes, and I want to thank both of you because the social-emotional tie-in to restorative practices is the work that I do a lot, and I have a lot of education that needs to happen around it so that principals and teachers understand why we're doing what we're doing. So thank you for this evening.
Yeah, you're so welcome. And let us keep this conversation growing throughout the country and the world because I don't think there's been a lot of specific emphasis about social-emotional learning and restorative practices, not as much as I would like. And that's partly why we chose to present that tonight as a provocative idea of how can we support that within growing systems.
Thank you for that.
You can go to the next slide or the last slide, Molly, unless there's somebody else that has their hand raised. But this,
I think we're good.
Okay, this is one of my favorite quotes that we're going to end with by Dr. Martin Luther King. We have no morally persuasive power with those who can feel our underlying contempt. And, you know, I just think that when we're going into environments and groups of people that are different from us, that it's really important that we take this idea to heart, that what we're coming to the conversation or the concern or the issue of a community or of a family, that we really keep in check our own judgments and projections and conclusions and self-righteousness, if you will, even. Because if we really want to make restorative practices kind of a household or a school-wide norm and practice, that we're going to have to form relationships with people who are different from us and come from some different points of view. And so I just want to leave us with that idea of what it is to really build strong partnerships and alliances that include a huge array and diversity of all beings. And with that, we thank you all for your listening and attention and the work that you're doing in your communities.
Thank you all so much.
And I just want to thank you, Jeffrey and Leah, for being a part of this 10-week journey with all of us, and to each of you for being a part of this. You're the people who are making things happen in your own communities and schools, and whether you're in a school or a citizen doing the work that you're doing to help build solutions, thank you. And on behalf of the Peace Alliance, I just want to remind you that in the near future, there'll be more upcoming opportunities that you might want to participate in. And of course, tonight's audio and slide presentation will be posted on the Teaching Peace course page, which all of you are familiar with. And we'll make sure that we all stay in touch. Thank you again on behalf of the Peace Alliance and the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice for teaching peace in schools. We'll see you in the near future, and thank you so much. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you, Molly. Bless you.